How's everybody doing? Welcome back to another episode of the Banker Next Door. So this is the continuing Lords of Easy Money series. This is part 15, and this is a little bit of a special episode because what we're going to be doing here is just doing a quick review of part two of the book, which consisted of chapters 7 through 12. So I did a review. If you go back, I think it was episode number 8. Was a review of part one of the book, which covered the first 6 chapters. So I'm doing these kind of section reviews, if you will, as a way to kind of catch people up quickly. So if you didn't have a chance, or if you didn't want to actually sit through listening to these previous 6 chapters, I'm hoping that you can listen to this as a way to kind of catch you up real quickly, especially as we barrel toward the end of the book here and getting into the third and final section. So with that being said, I want to bring in my little trusty PowerPoint slide here. So we're going to start here with chapter 7. And so what did we go over in chapter 7? Well, basically, we talked about forward guidance and Operation Twist. We talked about how QE basically became a normal tool of monetary policy. We talked about Bernanke's Plan B. So if you remember, so what Bernanke did was he kind of created these three options like A, B, C, with the intent that B was always going to be like the winning option. You know, it was always like, you know, C was always too little, A was always too much, and B was always kind of like just right in the middle. Then we talked about Richard Fisher's case study and the Fed's culture of sophistication. Basically snobby and snotty. a little Ferris Bueller's Day Off there for you. Snooty. All right. And then we went into Bernanke's speech at Jackson Hole. We talked about two threats at the time, which was foreign and domestic. We kind of got into, you know, the foreign issues, the domestic issue of politics, like the Tea Party and all that kind of stuff that was going on there. September 2012, the FOMC meeting and the presentation, which was absolutely horrible. It turned into this ridiculous presentation that had all of these projections and numbers that just were, I mean, just pie in the sky, total fantasy land type estimates. And it was pretty quite embarrassing looking back now at how bad that report was. But that was the report that they put forward and said, oh yeah, baby, this is what's going to bring us home. Then we got into the, you know, fundamental QE mistake and the mini insurrection, which was, you know, a couple of the Fed presidents there kind of getting together, Jeremy Powell and a couple other ones that were basically like not really in favor of just all on QE onslaught. And then we had the taper tantrum, you know, so basically what happened when the Fed tried to take their gas off the pedal. And then we got into QE, basically no end in sight. You know, the Fed had created this monster. Now they had to feed that monster. And basically, so they had to turn that QE on and not stop. And then we got into kind of Betsy Duke retires as one of the Fed governors. And then the effects of QE and Powell's warning. So Powell basically is warning the other Fed governors, basically saying that, hey, this may not be the best thing, that Tom Hawnagy might have had some points in what he was saying, and that we should, you know, kind of be very careful in how we tread. So that was chapter 7. And then we moved on to chapter 8, where this was kind of the chapter about Jeremy Powell and his background. So we talked about Powell's early years in D.C., Powell as a lawyer and as effective operator. Then he went to work for Dillon Reading Company. We learned a lot about corporate debt. We learned about corporate bond and versus a corporate loan. Powell moves to the Treasury. He uncovers, he has a big part in uncovering the Salmon Brothers corruption, which was Salmon Brothers trying to corner the Treasury's market. Then after all that was over, you know, Warren Buffett basically came in because he had a huge investment in Salmon Brothers, didn't want to lose his investment. The Oracle of Omaha had to come in and basically bail them out. Powell testifies in front of Congress. He basically got thrown to the wolves, but he did such a great job with this that he got kind of, you know, he impressed a lot of people. So George Bush doesn't get reelected. So then that kind of ends his tenure at the Treasury. And then Powell moves to the Carlyle Group. And the Carlyle Group, super powerful organization. And then at Carlyle Group is where he does what's called the Rexnord deal. And this is the deal that makes him a ridiculous amount of money. It's estimated he made somewhere between the neighborhood of $30 and $50 million off this deal. And then we kind of round it out with the crippling effects of a debt-heavy world. Okay, now we move into chapter nine. And we kind of, and here we really start talking about like, okay, how did the Fed does QE, but how does that play out in the actual financial institutions? And what gets pumped up is a little known product called the collateralized loan obligation, or the CLO. And we had a gentleman named Robert Hetu, who was, he was a big employee at Credit Suisse. And we talked about kind of the Credit Suisse lifestyle, about how this, you know, this guy was just going 24/7, 365. And that once the CLO sales got ramped up, it was just like nonstop, man. So then we talked about what they called the product, you know, companies like Rexnord out there became the product. We talked about the CLOs. And then we got into John Popp, who was another employee at Credit Suisse. And basically we talked about how were institutional investors supposed to earn a yield on their pools of cash when the Fed kept interest rates pinned at zero. And this is exactly how they were going to do it, with the CLO factory. Then we talked about how basically we got caught in a vice, you know. And then we talked about a business development corporation, or BDC. And then we basically said no one in the world of CLOs or leveraged loans seemed to think that they could lose. In other words, they basically started making riskier and riskier loans. They started making what were called covenant light or cov light loans, which were in stark contrast to what had normally been done and what had been done in the world of finance there for a long, long time. So basically, the ZERP policy and the quantitative easing, this was punishing anybody who was a saver, and it was forcing companies to reach for yield, meaning it's like, you got to do debt, you got to do deals if you want to make any money at all. But the money is super cheap. We're juicing it. We're going to plow that money in there. So there's all this incentive to do these deals. Okay, now we move on to chapter 10. And we get into basically the separation between Rexnord's leadership team and the rest of its workforce. And this is very important because of what became financial engineering. In other words, the profit the company made was not as important as the debt, as taking on debt, rolling the debt, and also basically putting that debt to work to do things such as stock buybacks, which would enrich shareholders and the executives of the company. All this being done at the expense of the employees. Now, why is this important? Well, because it had the exact opposite effect of what the Fed was trying to do with quantitative easing. The whole idea here was that these companies were going to take on debt, and then they were going to grow their business. They were going to grow the product lines. They were going to add more employees. And here we get to see the real world effects of what happened with this. We get to see how the leadership team, you know, got and lavishly enriched themselves, moved into plush accommodations, extracted themselves from working with the rest of the workforce. And then employees like John Feltner here, these guys, their reward was the Indianapolis plant that he worked at got shut down, and they moved all those jobs to Mexico just to save a few bucks, you know, and that's what ended up happening to this guy. And we talked about how it was more important to generate the most profit they could for Apollo Management, who owned the company, and doing stock buybacks, as opposed to basically taking care of your employees. And then we talked about basically the end game for Rexnord and Feltner. And we talked about Powell's role in Rexnord's fall. Basically, you know, Rexnord at the end of the day was left this debt riddled, you know, kind of broke company. That was there and was doing stuff. It was just limping along because of the massive amount of debt that had been put on top of it. And the problem was that this was, you know, this was 10 years after the fact. I mean, Jeremy Powell did his deal, got all his money, blew out of there. And then you know, you've got hundreds of employees, numerous plants, this whole operation that's basically left there, you know, picking up the pieces many years later. And by that point, everybody's forgotten about Jeremy Powell's role in this whole thing when he worked for the Carlyle Group. So it was a great, great example that was put out there. So, okay, let's move on here to chapter 11. Now we get back to our hero of the book. We get back to Tom Hoenig. And so basically Tom, at this point, he has retired from the Fed, but he's not done yet. He basically gets offered to go to DC to become a chairman for the FDIC. So Tom Hoenig goes to Washington. And then when he gets to Washington, he comes up with what's called, what became known as the Hoenig Rule. And he had basically written out an entire plan for how he was going to break up the big banks. And he was going to put the more mundane everyday stuff over here and the riskier stuff over here. Basically exactly what happened when you had the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial and investment banking. And that's basically what Tom Hoenig wanted to do. He wanted to put it back the way it used to be. Now, you know, Tom's out there, he's pushing for support, but unfortunately, the reality of Dodd-Frank sets in. There really wasn't the political will to break the banks up. And Washington had decided to go in the direction of they were going to mire the banks in a tremendous amount of regulation and new capital requirements and basically new laws and regs and everything else. And that was what was going to kind of pin the banks down and was going to give them all this oversight so they could just make sure that these banks stayed safe. However, as it turned out, the banks really weren't adding as much capital as they said they were. And Tom pointed this out, and Tom actually pushed for what was called tangible capital. And this was the one area where Tom actually won. He actually got a lot done here. He did eventually force the banks to hold more capital, which again turned out to be a very good thing. But what's interesting, though, is that as Tom was pushing for this, the Fed was actually moving in the opposite direction. And we basically, and then we because he was pushing to, you know, regulate the banks, break up the banks, have the banks have more capital. And, you know, and the Fed was basically like, no, we want you to pump that debt out, baby, pump that debt out, take on debt, pump it out, you know, pedal to the metal, keep going. And then we get into what was called this search for yield and how that basically bled into every single corner of the economy. And we talked about corporate debt and stocks. We talked about the oil industry. We talked about commercial real estate. We talked about the debt of developing nations. And then finally, we talked about how that this thing turned the very concept of yield upside down with negative rates. And we talked about how Europe had basically issued negative bonds. It's just an insane amount of negative bonds out there. And then we basically wrapped up the chapter with how Tom basically had no illusions about the reality of the current situation. You know, he did, you know, he understood what was going on, and he probably basically pushed for and fought for what he could try to do. And then finally, we come to chapter 11 or chapter 12, the last chapter for part two. And here we kick off with basically the quest for normalization. The Fed wants to try to normalize. And we begin with January 2014, where Janet Yellen comes in as chairman of the Federal Reserve. And Powell he's still worried. But he's also stamping down criticism of the Fed. And then we also have what's called the Powell shift. So in 2014, basically all the things that Powell was warning about, he basically stopped doing that, at least publicly. He stopped all the public criticism or doubts, if you will, around QE, around the ZERP policy. He basically, you know, he completely shifts his whole tone. And he did that because basically if he wanted to get anywhere, if he wanted to become chairman of the Federal Reserve, he was not going to get there basically, you know, saying the things he was saying. So we get to December of 2015. The Fed raises rates for the first time in 9 years. And then we get to January 2017, and, you know, fast forward a couple of years, and now President Trump comes into play. Donald Trump has been elected president. And we come into now January of 2018, and Janet Yellen's term, her four-year term as the Fed, has come to an end. Jeremy Powell has been selected. And at the same time, we have Tom Hoenig's time at the FDIC ends. So Tom's time ends and he very much unceremoniously gets kind of kicked to the curb at the end, which is really, you know, not cool. And like I said, if you watch the previous episode in 2014, when I talk about this, I mean, I really think that I hope that Tom gets a memoir one day where he gets lauded for this, the truths that he spoke. It was tough love. It was a lot of things that were difficult for people to hear, especially for bankers and regulators to hear, but he told the truth. He told the truth. He told what he truly felt. He stuck to his guns. And he was right about everything that he said. He was right about everything that he said. And history has vindicated him. Even today, to this very day, history has already vindicated him. And I hope that someday that we get a book that points that out. So now we get to February of 2018. Powell becomes the Fed chairman. And then we get into how when the Fed acted, it affected everything. Because the Fed, as the central bank, had put itself as the center of the economy. And when they pulled back and they started basically quantitative tightening by reducing their balance sheet and raising interest rates and stopped the quantitative easing, they were basically starting to, you know, trying to pivot the economy back to normalization. And in the process, they were basically, you know, just as Tom Hoenig said, you were not going to do that without cost. You were not going to do that without pain. And basically the pain and the cost started coming home. And so, and basically Jeremy Powell goes, hey, we're just going to keep on going with this and we're going to normalize. And basically, and then we see how they, the obfuscation and the market narrative, you know, there was always some other short-term reason why all this was happening. It wasn't what the Fed was doing. And so we get to December of 2018 and the total basically market shock, the over Christmas, the market just absolutely bottoms, drops 1,000 points. And then basically January 2019, Powell comes out, he puts out what they deem the Powell put, and basically normalization's over. It's all over. You know, and basically he says, you know, we're not going to reduce the balance sheet. We're not going to increase the interest rates. That's all over and done. And then basically the markets flash red and then Jeremy Powell starts cutting interest rates. And we end with the end where we leave off on September 17th, 2019. And it says the member of the FOMC gathered that day in Washington for the regularly scheduled meetings. But the meeting was overshadowed by urgent reports from the trading desks of the New York Fed. The obscure but vitally important market for overnight loans had seized up, otherwise known as the repo market. The problem was getting worse. If left unattended, it could lead to a financial crisis, maybe worse than the one in 2008. Very few people outside Wall Street even knew what was going on. The economy was as strong as it would be for years to come, but the financial system was so fragile, it was about to implode. And so that's where we left off for basically chapter 12. So now a little preview here of part three. So part three of the book is called Let Them Eat Assets. And this is the final four chapters. We get chapter 13, The Invisible Bailout, chapter 14, which is called Infection, chapter 15, Winners and Losers. And then chapter 16, we end with The Long Crash. So these are the four key chapters of the book. This is where the entire effects of QE and ZERP policy are laid bare for us all to see. We finally see the ultimate ramifications of these really bad policies. And we see where quantitative easing has ultimately taken us. So I really hope that everybody will, if you're enjoying this series, I really hope everybody will stick around because these last four chapters, this is where all the fireworks completely go off. So, and my plan here is to basically next week to bring you chapters 13 and 14, the following week, bring you chapters 15 and 16. And then the final week, I'm going to do a recap of the book and I'm going to go over a whole bunch of current numbers and charts. We're going to look at the Fed balance sheet. We're going to look at the repo market. We're going to look at the treasury market. We're going to look at everything that we're currently at, and we're going to see how everything the Fed has done over the last 15, 16 years has led us to this moment of exactly where we are today. So if you're liking this series, I like I said, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe. That always, that will definitely help this series. It will help the channel. If you have any comments, please leave those comments below. I am absolutely loving and enjoying the feedback and the comments that I'm getting on this series. So please leave those comments and I will get back to you as quick as I possibly can. Make sure to come back for the last few episodes. And if you're liking the series, please make sure to like and subscribe, and please make sure to go check out some of the other content on the channel. If you're liking the series, I got a lot of other great stuff out there, and please make sure to check out the Banking Update, which is the main show of the channel, which I try to put out every Sunday. And I will hope to see everybody back here again next week. And until then, have a great week. And I will see you back here again soon. Thanks a lot.